are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. By the time of her execution at 36, Maria Mandel had achieved the highest rank possible for a woman in the Third Reich. As head overseer of the women's camp at Auschwitz-Birkenau, she was personally responsible for the murders of thousands and for the torture and suffering of countless more. In this riveting biography, Susan J. Eyscheid explores how Maria Mandel, regarded locally as a nice girl from a good family, came to embody the very worst of humanity. Born in 1912 in the scenic Austrian village of Münzkirchen, Maria enjoyed a happy childhood with loving parents, who later watched in anguish as their grown daughter rose through the Nazi system. Mandel's life mirrors the period in which she lived, turbulent, violent, and suffused with paradoxes. At Auschwitz-Birkenau, she founded the notable women's orchestra and adopted several children from the transports, only to lead them to the gas chambers when her interest waned. After the war, Maria was arrested for crimes against humanity. Following a public trial attended by the international press, she was hanged in 1948. For two decades, Eyscheid has excavated the details of Mandel's life story, drawing on archival testimonies, speaking to dozens of witnesses, and spending time with Mandel's community of friends and neighbors who shared their memories as well as those handed down in their families. The result is a chilling and complex exploration of how easily an ordinary citizen chose the path of evil in a climate of hate and fear. The book that we're featuring this evening is Mistress of Life and Death, The Dark Journey of Maria Mandel, the head overseer of Auschwitz-Birkenau, with my special guest, musician and author, Susan J. Eyscheid. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Susan Eyscheid.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this very impressive and extraordinary book.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Now, by training and your credentials, you are a musician and a classical oboist, and you had a strong interest, you write, in music and musicians of the Holocaust. Tell us how you became involved with writing this book about Maria Mandel and the connection to your primary interest, which is music. Tell us about that.
Sure. I've been a performer and performing musician for many years now. And early on in my career, in addition to playing in orchestras and teaching at a university, I began to perform music that was written in the Holocaust and doing a lot of research into the topic. And as part of my research and discovery of this amazing material about music, I also discovered the many musical activities that existed in Hitler's camps and ghettos. Somewhat extraordinarily, most of the concentration and death camps had artistic activities, including musical activities. And I became very interested in an orchestra that was formed in the death camp of Auschwitz-Birkenau. This orchestra was unique in that it was the only women's orchestra in the entire Nazi camp system. And as I learned more about the orchestra and began to interview survivors of that orchestra, I became acquainted with the story of Maria Mandel, and she was the highest-ranking SS female auxiliary in the camps. She was the head overseer at Auschwitz-Birkenau during a lot of the story that I tell. And so I became interested in her, like how did this person responsible for so many deaths and atrocities also have this side where she found great comfort and solace in music. And however, inadvertently, she did create the orchestra, which in turn helped save the lives of the women in that orchestra, although that certainly wasn't her primary intent. And so as I dug more and more into Mandel's story and learned more about her, I discovered that she wasn't sort of intrinsically evil, natural-born killer. She had been born into a very warm, supportive, loving family. She was always known as a very nice girl from a good family. And for me, the greatest question which then emerged was this idea of how this otherwise normal, compassionate, nice person turned into an extraordinarily evil perpetrator in the Holocaust, and sort of what factors led to that transformation and sort of the things we could learn from that in a broader sense. So that's sort of how I got into the topic.
Incredible. Let's talk about that upbringing and what you learned from it. Talk about, she was born in 1912 in a beautiful Austrian village of, and I'll get you to pronounce this properly, Munskirchen. Tell us about her early life and her parents.
Sure. The village is Munskirchen. And if you're familiar at all with German and Austrian geography, probably the largest town is Passau in Germany. It's on a conjunction of three rivers, and Munskirchen is across one of the rivers in a more rural part of Austria. Her parents, her father's name was Franz Mandl, and he was a master shoemaker. He had sort of a big business in town. With, like most of the people who lived in Munskirchen then, there was also an accompanying farm where they grew all their own food. And Maria's mother was named Anna, and she was also from a nearby village. Together, they had four children, of which Maria was the baby, so she was the youngest child. And she was raised in this very nurturing household. Again, that was in the 1920s, you know, in Austria. So the norms were somewhat different than we're used to. Women were very much second-class citizens. So
sure.
Usually her goal growing up, and most of the young women, was they aimed to get married and have a family. And that was sort of the considered and expected thing. Maria's mother suffered from depression throughout her lifetime. So she had a lot of challenges. But ultimately, Maria grew up in this family, and until the Anschluss, which is when Austria was annexed by Germany, her life was really on a good trajectory. She had gotten a job in the local post office. She was engaged to be married to a young man in the community. And so everything was going pretty well for her until that point.
Tell us about her father's political leanings and how that got her fired from the post office. And what was the climate at that time, regarding people that didn't sign up for the National Socialist Party?
Sure. Well, Munskirchen, especially in the years leading up to the Anschluss, had a couple of different political parties. There were the Nazi Party coming up, or VPA, my German accent's not great, which was a Christian Social Democrat kind of party. So Franz Mandl was sort of a leader in that party and in the community. And so her family was definitely not Nazi. They did not support the Nazis. Franz was actually pretty outspoken against the Nazis. And then, of course, when the Nazis came to power, that was the big reason her then fiancé was a member of the Nazi Party, was coming up in the ranks. And he essentially dumped her. He said, I can't have a fiance, or, you know, my future wife cannot be someone who does not support the Nazi Party. So I think the great irony of Maria's life and the great tragedy for all of her victims down the road is that had she not been fired for not being a Nazi from this job, she probably would not have followed this path into evil that she ended up pursuing.
Interesting. Now, what does she do in response to this heartbreak of the fiancé? Where does she travel to, and what does she try to get a job doing, and what does she end up working?
Sure. Well, after she lost her job, I think she was just looking for a new start, a new beginning. So she traveled to Munich, where she had some family. I believe her uncle was living there. And at the time, begun to see the establishment of some of the early concentration camps. And at that point, there was only one concentration camp specifically designated for women, and that was Lichtenberg, which was in Germany. And they needed to recruit personnel to be guards in the camp. Most of the young men were either being recruited into the army or working at other camps for men. So they decided to embark on a kind of classified ad campaign where they were trying to attract women to apply for these positions. So they actually put ads in the paper. Overseers sought, I think the phrase they used was, a camp for asocial women, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Not really stating explicitly that it was a concentration camp and what all, that all signified. And I believe Maria's uncle saw the ad in the paper and said, why don't you apply for this? And so she literally was just looking for a job. and went ahead and applied for one of those guard positions at Lichtenberg. And ironically, she said at that time, if I hadn't gotten this job, I would have trained to become a nurse. And I always sort of thinking of how she transformed later, shudder at the thought, but that might have been the saving of her as well. So, you know, it's hard to say in hindsight. So she ended up being hired, and that's how she began her camp service.
Tell us, as you write in the book, about some of the training and the indoctrination used to prepare these women for the overseers at these concentration camps, this one in particular.
Sure. Well, at Lichtenberg, they were just beginning to standardize the training for the young overseers. But Grant, usually they would apprentice to someone who'd been there and follow them around for a couple of months until they were able to assume their own responsibilities. Later on, it became pretty sophisticated way of training. It was like you were desensitizing these guards to the humanity of the prisoners. You were creating what later came to be called a culture of cruelty, where you would be rewarded. The crueler you were, the more praise you would get, the more they normalized the behavior. And after a while, although some women, you know, just once they realized what was happening left, most of them stayed and became sort of indoctrinated in that system and accepted that as their new reality and as a way to, you know, move forward with a good job and benefits and a place to live and all of those things. And certainly Maria did that. She assimilated very quickly. That's one of the interesting things about her story. It's almost like one day she was this sweet, beautiful, young, innocent woman. And some of the early prisoners there remember her that way. And then almost overnight, she transformed into one of the most brutal guards there. In turn, got a lot of praise for that. And then that allowed her to race through the ranks. Down the road, when she had moved to other camps, I'm sure we'll talk about Ravensbrück in a minute, she became sort of the overseer for all of the training of young women in that camp. And by the end of the war, they had trained, I think, between 3,000 and 4,000 young women in these roles. So it wasn't just a few women. There were a lot of women who decided to follow this path as well.
What were the living quarters like for the prisoners at Lichtenberg? And what were the living accommodations for the staff like Maria?
The living quarters for the prisoners were pretty brutal. Lichtenberg is like an old castle. I think it dates from the medieval period or the Renaissance period. So it's this big stone, dark, dank edifice with these huge sort of lofty kinds of rooms. And for the prisoners, they literally crammed, you know, hundreds of prisoners in a room, very little means of sanitation. They might have like one bucket that everybody would use as the bathroom. And most of the women were engaged in hard labor out during the day, either outdoor labor or inside labor, creating things that could be sold or textiles or things like that. Where the guards lived at Lichtenberg, I don't know a lot about that. There's not a lot of documentation. Most of them, I believe, either had separate quarters in the castle that were considerably nicer or lived out in the community very close to the campsite and then came into work.
You say at that time, Maria began to beat people, certainly.
Yes, that's correct.
What was the event that inspired her more than anything to succeed, I guess, in this new environment?
I think it was a combination. I think she really, to my mind, had a kind of breakdown after being dumped by her fiancé. There was really a great stigma in Germany and in Austria at that time for a woman. She was in her mid-20s now. She wasn't married. She had always wanted children. So the fact that she had no man in sight and had lost her job, I think this was a way where she could get respect. She had power. She could sort of fight back against this perception that she wasn't worthy because, you know, he had dumped her. So I think she got all of those things through this job. And gradually she just did what she needed to do to be successful in the job and climbed the ranks very quickly.
Now, there was talk of a new camp being built and Ravensbrück. And so tell us about Maria being assigned to this new facility.
Sure. Eventually, as the war kicked off and more women were being arrested, Himmler made the decision to build a new concentration camp just for women. It was located north of Berlin near a little town called Fürstenberg. And this new camp was called Ravensbrück. And so most of the personnel from Lichtenberg, they essentially closed down Lichtenberg as a women's camp and transported all of the guards and then a lot of the prisoners up to Ravensbrück. By this point, Maria was one of the more experienced guards, and she had gotten a lot of responsibility because she was so willing to take those next steps into brutality. So she would be in charge of beatings and things like that at Lichtenberg. So when she got to Ravensbrück, she was immediately one of the higher ranking overseers. She wasn't yet the highest ranking, but she certainly got a lot of responsibility right out of the gates. And like all those women began to oversee work details and again, climb her ladder again at that camp.
You talk about that even though she wasn't officially in the SS, she had these responsibilities foisted on her, which she ascribed to, which she volunteered for, but she was still a subordinate of the SS men, wasn't she?
Yes, the function of the women in the camps was a little different. They weren't considered full-blown SS. They were considered the SS woman's auxiliary. So they were like an auxiliary to the SS. So, they couldn't have like the military ranks like people of the SS had, but within their own purview, within a woman's camp, they certainly were responsible for the disciplining of the prisoners, the running of the camp. So in most aspects, they were doing what the men did. They just didn't get sort of that official designation. So all these women function as like an SS auxiliary, I guess is the best way to put it, in these camps.
You say by September 1st, 1939, when the Third Reich invaded Poland and the Second World War began, the work routines and procedures at Ravensbrück were well established. And you say that on January 4th, 1940, Heinrich Himmler came to inspect the camp. Tell us about that a little, as you write, this inspection by this elite SS official.
Yeah, that was a really big day for the overseers in the camp. It was this bitterly cold winter day. We have some photographs that exist from that visit, like you can see them through the Ravensbrück archive and things like that. And essentially, he came to inspect the women guards. So there's this one photo of them all lined up in this row, in a double row, and then he's sort of striding in front of them, sort of inspecting the ranks. And then he had a series of meetings during the day with different personnel to sort of strategize about different policies in the camp. Maria's immediate supervisor was a woman named Johanna Langenfeld. And so she's also seen in this picture sort of walking subserviently behind him because, of course, she was female. But that was sort of a very big event for all of the female overseers that he had come to this camp and was sort of establishing the camp as this really important entity, I guess, in the camp system. So those pictures are really pretty extraordinary. If you can find them online, they're very easy to find. So anyway, it's worth taking a look.
You talk about people that were comprised and the transport of new prisoners and the early capacity of this, or the early population of the camp, and then the soon rising population of that camp.
Yes, I mean, the camp exponentially got bigger. At first, when Maria first got there, the population was still under control. The barracks were new. They planted flowers. They had a little zoo. I mean, it was sort of crazy. And then, of course, as more and more women were arrested through the war, through political dissension, for whatever reason, and sent to the camp, things got crowded and more crowded. Conditions got worse and worse and worse. And during the couple of years that Maria worked in that camp, the population increased exponentially, like five or six times. And so then by the end, it was just horrible conditions of extreme overcrowding, difficult sanitation, insufficient food. And again, all of those conditions that we're familiar with when we study the camps became very apparent over her tenure there.
You talk about some of the punishments that were enacted, whipping table, some of the weapons that they were given, the guards, were canes. They each had pistols. They had big high boots that they could use to kick and beat these prisoners. This was all encouraged by witness accounts.
Oh, absolutely. Those were considered necessary things to keep order. Most of the women guards also worked with dogs, so they would have, a couple of dogs that were trained to attack. And again, the more brutal, the better. So all the prisoners remember just vividly these horrible punishments. A lot of times they said one of the worst things was you could be punished for anything. And eventually everything was against the rules, so you would just accept that you would have a risk of being attacked at any time. There was a large building called the bunker, which became a kind of cell block where they sent prisoners for extra special, extra harsh punishments. And Mandel was eventually appointed as sort of co-overseer of the whole bunker. So that was like a big promotion for her. And that's some of the most brutal stories of punishments come out of her time in the bunker, as well as just overseeing things like roll calls, which were a complete nightmare for the women. They'd have to stand out there and out for hours in freezing cold or extreme heat. You know, I think Maria, I don't know if it had something to do with her father's being a shoemaker, but she seemed obsessed with creating problems for the women's feet. Like there was this really sharp kind of stone roadway. And so she would force the women to be in their bare feet and sort of march over and over these stones till their feet were bleeding and infected. And even in winter, they weren't allowed to, you know, have shoes or any kind of protection. And so you can imagine the horrible injuries, many of which resulted in death. So the brutalities and the conditions that the prisoners endured were really almost beyond description.
You say that Maria became known as the mistress of life and death and nicknamed the Tigress. You also talk about that it seemed to be a sexual element to the punishments that Maria inflicted on these prisoners. Also that prisoners were also used as prostitutes for German soldiers as well. Tell us about some of this seemingly sexual deviancy on Maria's part.
Well, in her case, I think it was more about power than about sexuality. Like, for example, sometimes she would order, if a woman was being beaten in front of the whole camp or whipped, that she would be stripped so she would be naked when that happened. And there was another guard there, Dorothea Binz, who definitely had more of a sexual overtone. She would literally go into sexual frenzies when she was beating prisoners. And sometimes when you read accounts, people get the two of them mixed up. And I think in Maria's case, it was more that she reveled in the power she had over the women rather than getting direct sexual gratification from that per se. At least that's the way I read it for her. As regards the prostitutes and forcing women, she was sort of interested that, for example, a few years later in Auschwitz, if a German prisoner came in and they wanted to assign her to the brothel for the SS men, and Mandel would try and talk them out of it. Like, as a good German woman, this is not something you wanted to do. Whereas on the other hand, at places like Ravensbrück and also at Auschwitz and other camps, if was part of her undesirable population, maybe someone who's being targeted, someone who was Jewish, someone who was a Jehovah's Witness, then she certainly would have had no compunction about sending them to service a brothel. But it was always this sort of weird, I don't know, paradoxical view towards sexuality that she evidenced in different ways throughout her camp service.
You say that she was especially cruel to Jehovah's Witnesses. And also you write about this extraordinary, people were selected, Maria selected people for something you call a lab rabbits. Tell us about this experimentation and the selection of it.
Oh, yes. This is one of the, I don't know, really devastating chapters of the Holocaust, if you can dare to consider one chapter more devastating than another.
Yes.
The lab rabbit program at Ravensbrück sprang out of the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich. And in retaliation, anyway, you can read the whole story of the retaliation against that. But there was this big influx of women into Ravensbrück as sort of a result of that. And Himmler was also, at the same time, Heydrich was blown up. And at this point, the German soldiers were fighting on all these fronts. So they were experiencing these really horrific injuries, blast injuries, that kind of stuff. So he charged the Ravensbrück doctors with this kind of faux medical program, where they were going to do a series of experiments on the women to try to figure out the best ways of treating like blast injuries or this kind of stuff, that they could then transfer that expertise out into the field for the German soldiers.
Right.
So they put Mandel in charge of selecting a bunch of young women for this program. And so at this point, there had been a couple of recent transports from Lublin, Poland, of young teenagers, like 16 to 20-year-old young women, perfect health. And so she chose a lot of them to be part of this experimental program. And so what the doctors did is they took these women into like a separate wing in the infirmary, and they inflicted all of these horrible wounds on their legs. Sometimes they shot their legs. Sometimes they would operate and insert things like dirt or metal or something, then they'd slap a cast over it, and then they just watched to see what would happen. And as you can imagine, the incredible suffering, the pain. Many women died from these experimentations. people who survived, they were just horrible injuries. They were crippled for life. And there are, we do have photographs of some of those victims who survived. And ultimately, they became known in the camp as the lab rabbits, or sort of these experimental subjects for these horrific set of medical experiments that took place at Ravensbrück. So it was pretty overwhelming. I did get to interview one of those lab rabbits several years later, of course. And
yes,
she still, you know, literally was only able to work a year or two, and then her body couldn't take it. Still had this huge, you know, one of her legs was permanently crippled. And just hearing her talk about the agony, and they would be crying and sobbing for help. And, you know, they would just be locked in these wards with these separating wounds. And, you know, many women went delirious. They had no water. It just really brought home the suffering in a very personal way to me, being able to talk with her and for her having the courage to share that story with me.
Let's use this as an opportunity to hear these messages. Now, you write about that after only 4 months as head overseer in Auschwitz, Johanna Langfeldt was struggling and fell in a disagreement with the commandant, Rudolf Haas. And so she was transferred back to Ravensbrück. And tell us where Maria was transferred to as a result.
Okay, yeah, that's a really interesting story. Johanna Langfeldt, again, had been Mandel's supervisor at Ravensbrück. When Auschwitz was formed and then got to be big and had a women's camp, Rudolf Hirsch, who was the commandant, was seeking an experienced head overseer there. So they sent Langfeldt to Poland, and that's when Maria Mandel was promoted to being head overseer at Ravensbrück. Langfeldt didn't prove to be successful at Auschwitz, as you said. She always was known among the prisoners as being a little, not quite as harsh, and she struggled to control the women overseers there, and the camp itself was just a sort of nightmarish cesspool of disease and filth, and she just couldn't handle the job. So they made the decision to transfer her back to Ravensbrück. And at that point, Maria Mandel was transferred to Auschwitz against her will to become the head overseer there. And so that's how she ended up at the next stage of her career in Poland, which was in Auschwitz.
You're right. There were three main camps, Auschwitz I, which was built in 1940, Auschwitz II, Birkenau, and Auschwitz III, which was the Monowitz-Brune, a subsidiary of the IG Farben Company. You say that the very first thing that Maria noticed at Auschwitz was the horrible smell, and reminiscent of her father's shoemaking business, where he would often have hides that were overripe and used in the making of shoes. So she was familiar somewhat with the smell of the dead, we'll say.
Yes. Most of the people, or everyone I talk to, or when you read survivor accounts, Auschwitz-Birkenau, especially because that became one of the main killing centers, always had this kind of miasma in the air. Could be smoky, you know, the undercurrent of the smell of death, of, you know, all let you use your, you can imagine the sort of the graphic things that went into that smell. But yeah, it was like, for a lot of people, it became almost another entity, that this stench that you could never escape from, and you could never escape the reality of what this place was and what was happening there. And certainly the smell was part of that.
You write that things are accelerating. The population is growing. Talk about in 1943, after a general roll call, and there was a witness to this, there was 4,000 were released or were selected for the gas chamber. And Maria ordered the kitchen to prepare 4,000, as a result, less dinners.
Yes, that's correct.
Now, these roll calls had become routine for Maria. And tell us about the treatment, that even though the horrible conditions for the prisoners, what were the conditions like for the staff like Maria?
Well, the roll calls are just one of the truly horrific things that the prisoners endured. You know, on the surface, you say roll call and you say, oh, that doesn't sound so bad. But the reality was just appallingly horrible. Again, you're out there in all hours, all weathers, all hours. You had to stand still. If the count didn't match and it never matched, then, you know, they would start over. People would die. It was just really, really horrible. At Auschwitz, Maria was more high ranking. She was the head overseer. So the lower ranking overseers were the ones who, you know, we're out there and sort of doing the counts and all that kind of things. And then Mandel would stroll in after a couple hours and receive those reports of the numbers at the head table or wherever they had set up to do the counts. So at Auschwitz, she didn't have to do as much of that kind of nitty-gritty standing there supervising, because the overseers were also out there in the weather trying to get these counts. She didn't care if people were suffering. She just sometimes she would order the roll call extended just for her amusement or things like that. But yeah, it was a huge part of, in her case, because she was so high ranking, she usually came in near the end of the roll calls and then, you know, sort of received the reports from the other overseers.
Can we talk about some of the luxuries that the staff enjoyed while these other people had no heat, water, or sanitation?
Sure. The SS were housed in lovely quarters. They had their own stores. They had concerts on the weekend. Mandel lived in it was sort of a communal dwelling at first where they had housed all the female overseers, but eventually she got her own villa where she could live and sort of escape to, if you will, when she was done with work. Of course, they had access to the best foods. And don't forget, I mean, the enormous amounts of plunder that were coming into Auschwitz, every transport that came in, of course, everybody tried to bring something with them. In most cases, if you were only limited to what you could carry, if you had any wealth left, maybe you had a diamond or something, you would hide it on your person. As those people were filtered to the gas chambers and, you know, they were forced to disrobe. So all of this plunder, money, instruments, jewelry, anything you could imagine. There was a huge compound called Canada and Birkenau where there were just warehouses full of this plunder. And so it was fairly easy, although officially it wasn't allowed. Certainly most of the SS did help themselves to a lot of these perks. And certainly Maria Mandel benefited from them as well.
Maria met a SS officer, Joseph Janisch, and had an affair with him. He was responsible mostly or more so for construction of the crematorium. Tell us about this brief affair and what happened. And as you write, it seemed to soften her behavior during that time period.
Yeah, Janisch was a young man from Salzburg. So he was a fellow Austrian, tall, handsome. The word among the prisoners is that he just did his job with the architectural commando. He didn't, you know, wasn't gratuitously cruel or anything. Although she had certainly had other affairs over the years, I think she was really the big love interest she had since the fiance who dumped her. And so I'm sure she was probably envisioning a life after the war, and maybe this would be her chance for a marriage, maybe for children. And they would be seen like at dawn or after in the evenings, they had these horses and she would always have on a white shirt with a red rose in it. And they would gallop across the camp and spend all this time together. Eventually he was transferred and then their relationship weren't able to keep it going long distance. And so once he left, she reverted to being again, once the sort of this very cruel overseer that she had become.
You write about the executions, the selection for these executions, and then after what was termed good executions, I guess, there were reported drunken orgies among the officers and the staff, overseers.
Sure. That was pretty normal.
Tell us about some of the minions that Maria had under her that were under her charge.
Well, sure. She was in charge of all the other female overseers. And there were some very colorful personalities and brutal personalities. One of the ones that she had ended up having a lot of contact down the road was a woman named Teresa Brandl.
Yes.
Sort of quieter, not quite as brutal, but ultimately was arrested and then executed with Mandel the same day. Probably the most notorious was a young woman named Irma Greza. And she was sort of the stereotype of the young, beautiful blonde. She was in her early 20s, incredibly brutal, incredibly cruel. She drove Maria crazy because she was always doing things like stealing resources like turpentine, which all the women used to clean their boots. And so she would hog it and sort of hoard it. And then Mandel would always have to reprimand her for that. So she was another one of the sort of minions under her. There was a large woman named Alice Orlovsky who was enormously cruel. I could go on and on. I mean, there were many, many women who worked under her. And again, she was sort of oversaw all of their actions. And that was one of her big responsibilities, which also drove her crazy quite a lot, I think.
You're right. Also, we didn't mention that there's the notorious Dr. Mengele working with her closely with her at this camp as well.
Yes, I'm sure a lot of people know about Josef Mengele. He was the notorious SS physician, also engaged in horrific experiments on children, on twins. He was also a great lover of music, and I think that was primarily Mandel's contact with him, because when she formed the Women's Orchestra, Mengele became a regular attendee at their Sunday concerts. And so I think for Mandel, it was this way. She was sort of seeking credibility and maybe some more respect from the male SS, which really the women rarely got. So for her, it would serve the purpose. Both she loved music, but also it gave her like this in with officers like Mengele, who were quite important in the camp.
Now let's get to what's a very important part of this story, and you titled the orchestra. You say that Maria had an idea of forming a women's orchestra. Both men's camps had orchestras and music ensembles, and they entertained the SS on regular Sunday concerts and special functions. Tell us why it was important, you feel, that Maria had organized this orchestra, and tell us about the formation of this group and Alma Rose.
Sure. So again, for a lot of the same reasons, she saw that the other parts of the Auschwitz camp had men's orchestras. She saw that that got status and respect for those officers that supported that. And so because she was the head of the women's camp, she got the idea of founding a women's orchestra. So because women couldn't do anything on their own, she enlisted the aid of a male SS officer and Hersler. And sort of together, they sponsored the formation of this orchestra. It took a while to get successful. At first, they recruited musicians from incoming transports and population. Orchestra did not sound very good. They were mostly young female musicians without a lot of training, very inexperienced. And so it was really sort of up in the air whether the orchestra would survive because they weren't performing at a high enough level. And then someone noticed that in one of the incoming transports, there was a musician named Alma Rose. And she was a very well-known virtuoso violinist, conductor, musician, and was well-known in Europe. Her uncle was the famous composer Gustav Mahler, if for the musicians out there. And so once Mandel heard that Alma Rose had been brought into the camp, she assigned her to be the conductor of the women's orchestra. And because Alma was such a wonderful, talented musician, a great leader, she single-handedly really turned this orchestra into something that was very viable. They rehearsed all day. Rose was able to arrange music. They had sort of a weird eclectic instrumentation depending on what was available. And so she knew how to arrange programs that would please the SS. And she figured out a way to work with Maria Mandel. And there was actually a huge furor in the camp because one time Mandel summoned her to her office to talk about the orchestra and asked her to sit while they were talking. And someone saw that, and that was never done. You know, a prisoner would never sit with an SS officer. And so that was all over the camp in like the next 10 seconds because people were so shocked. So I think Mandel had a great deal of respect for Alma Rose. Alma Rose, I can't imagine how she stood up to the stress. She was trying to walk this horrible tightrope of keeping the musicians alive, keeping the orchestra playing at a high enough standard. And sadly, Alma Rose did not survive the war. She died in the next year, we think probably of botulism poisoning. But in her heyday, she certainly, the women in the orchestra were very proud of what they achieved. And I think sometimes, like if you watch some of the movies that have been made about the women's orchestra, the orchestra is presented as not playing very well or things. But I trust the opinion of the musicians I talked to, and they said they always knew they were playing well when Alma said, I wish my father could have heard that. He would have liked that. And for them, that was the highest praise. And that meant that they were performing at a very high standard.
Weirdly, the orchestra was used for nefarious purposes as well. For transports, you write, that would come into a camp and they would be lulled into some kind of passivity or try to. The orchestra would have that purpose. But also you write about something called the gate, and also that the orchestra would play particular marches and the prisoners on these roll calls would have to be in step or else.
Yeah, that was one of their big responsibilities. Apart from these weekly concerts, every morning and every evening, they had to go set up by the gate to the camp. Auschwitz and Birkenau, in addition to being a death camp, was also a slave labor camp. And so every day, these large commandos, thousands of women would have to march in and out of the camp. And so to keep them moving and keep some kind of order, the orchestra would play these marches on the sidelines. And sort of the prisoners were forced to keep in step coming and going outside of the camp. Sometimes they would have them play outside on the ramp when the transports were coming, again, just to lull those transports into a false sense of security. You know, if you heard music, surely this can be a bad place. And so they were used for a lot of, again, I have to mention that these responsibilities were just took an enormous toll on the musicians. They, years later, the women that survived just had this horrible emotional trauma, great moral conflict. They were, of course, playing because they wanted to live like everybody else wanted to live, but they witnessed firsthand so much brutality towards the other prisoners. It just was a real moral, created a lot of moral suffering for those musicians.
They were very conflicted as well because they knew that their position as musicians under Alma Rose was the way that they had somewhat of a privileged conditions to live in. And you include some of those little privileges that they really took to heart, but they were treated differently because they were in that orchestra.
That is correct. I mean, I think it's still important to caution that although their conditions were better, a lot better than a lot of the other prison population, the conditions were still enormously difficult for them. And there was also resentment, of course, from the other prisoners who didn't have those sort of, I don't know, you know, I don't want to call them perks because they weren't perks, but slightly better conditions. So again, that also contributed to the moral dilemma and suffering of the musicians.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages. Now, you write, in summer of 1944, large Hungarian transports arrive and the entire camp of Auschwitz-Birkenau was mobilized for mass slaughter. And then Maria's mother died as well, to compound this anger.
Yes, that's correct.
You also write about her returning to her hometown and how she did that. Just tell us about that appearance in her hometown.
Sure. I mean, during her camp service, Maria went back to Munskirchen periodically. As she rose in rank and became more and more important in the Nazi hierarchy, I think she wanted to sort of rub the noses of the people in the community who maybe had looked down on her because she was a woman or because she lost her fiance or for whatever reason. So she would usually come dressed in full dress uniform, sometimes in an SS car, usually with a, you know, a male SS officer accompanying her. And so she very much wanted to make an impact when she came back home and into the community. And so we know of several documented visits where she came home. She did come home the summer after her mother died for the funeral. She came home later that year. And this was late 1944. So again, the war would end in 1945. So this was near the end for her of her camp service. But those visits were remembered very vividly by the townspeople. And so I was able to talk to a lot of people who remembered very specific accounts of those visits home.
Tell us when the Allies finally, it looks like it's certain defeat. You say Maria leaves the camp within just a few days being able to escape. Tell us about what happens after the Allies liberate the camps.
Sure. Well, Auschwitz was sort of winding out of existence at the end of 1944. The Nazis were beginning to flee ship. The Russians were getting close to the camp. Maria had been transferred before the end of the year to a camp called Mühldorf, which is outside of, again, vicinity of Munich in Germany. And so Auschwitz was liberated by the Russians in January of 1945. Maria, by this point, was stationed at Mühldorf, where she remained for the rest of the war. We don't have a lot of accounts of her there. She was sort of she was still the head overseer, but I think she was keeping a lower profile. A lot of the Nazis were sensing that they were going to lose the war, although they weren't allowed to say that. And then, of course, the Allied forces came into Europe after D-Day. And so that part of Germany was liberated by the Americans. We know that at Mühldorf that the American army was getting very, very close. She literally bugged out with the camp commandant just a couple hours before the Americans got to the camp. Fled first to Munskirchen and then on to her sister's house in this little hamlet called Luck. And she remained there for the next couple of months. Ultimately, someone informed on her and she was arrested at her sister's house and then was taken into custody in August of 1945 and sent to a POW enclosure for German prisoners of war that they set up at the former concentration camp of Dachau.
Now, you talk about that this now is a prison for these Nazi criminals. and that the Red Cross was monitoring the condition, and people were enlisted to make sure that these people were in good health for these upcoming trials, weren't they?
Yes, they were very concerned with keeping them in good shape. They wanted to have very public war crimes trials. Of course, the Nuremberg trials were going on about this time, so everybody was sort of looking ahead to the next wave of prosecution of these war criminals. So that was sort of, Maria was Dachau at that point, sort of in waiting for extradition. They had decided that a lot of them would be tried in places where their greatest atrocities happened, I guess. And so because Maria was so influential at Auschwitz-Birkenau, the decision was made to put her on an extradition train to back to Poland, where she would stand trial with a bunch of leading members of the Auschwitz camp staff. So that was, they were sort of preparing them for that extradition.
She would be part of the second Auschwitz trial, as it was coined. But the first Auschwitz trial resulted in, as you say, a public hanging. And so the second trial had its problems with succeeding shortly after that. And they didn't want to have a public hanging in the second trial, did they?
Well, the first Auschwitz trial was just for one man. That was Rudolf Hirsch. He was the commandant of Auschwitz. And so the second trial, which is, they referred to it as the second because his had happened first, then tried 40 members of the Auschwitz staff sort of as part of that. In the interim, there were other trials going on. There was one in Stutthof near Gdańsk, and Stutthof was one of the camps in the northern part of Poland. And that happened before Maria's trial. And the public mood was still very much revenge, that, you know, that people wanted to see them hang publicly. So there was a huge public hanging up there for the Stutthof personnel. But it had sort of adverse effects in that, you know, a lot of people went with their kids, but then kids didn't really understand what was happening. So some of the children began playing hanging games, and some children died from that. And so there was this really very sad fallout as a result of that public spectacle. And by the time they gathered all the people together and got all the depositions and things in preparation for Mandel's trial, public sentiment had calmed down a little bit. They definitely wanted to see these people executed if they were guilty, but the trend was now away from holding a public execution.
You introduce an important character at this time, Margit Burda. So she becomes a prisoner when Russia came into power, and she was sent to Dachau as well and became Maria's cellmate.
Yes, I think if I can claim any kind of research triumph in such a sad story, it was finding Margit Burda. She was Maria's best friend during the war, or not during the war, but after the war. She was held in Dachau, was transported with Maria to Poland, and was with Maria the whole time she was in prison, right till shortly before her execution. Margit was, she was just a wonderful spirit. She really had done nothing wrong. She was just working as a secretary at an office in Krakow, and so was sort of rounded up with these others. Ultimately was totally acquitted of any kind of crimes and was sent back to Germany. But she only knew Maria Mandel as this wonderful, kind, supportive friend. And so was like this view, you know, I had all these testimonies and talked to survivors who just knew the brutal Mandel. And then I talked to Margit Burda, who just sort of showed this other side of Maria's personality. And so it was really earth-shaking to get to know her and to speak with her many times. We began a long correspondence and did several visits with her. And so she really shared this other side of Maria's personality, which was revelatory in a lot of ways. And when you talk about this dichotomy that every person has good and evil in them, I think, as horrific as Mandel's actions were, and I would never dream of negating the huge suffering and that she caused, she also has this other side. And it's perhaps inconvenient to acknowledge that, but it was certainly there.
You talk about that they fanned across Poland to look for testimonies, for potential witnesses against these Nazis and Maria as well. And they took photos from their mugshots and enlarged them and put them up in important and major cities in the town squares. And you write that many, many people came forward, many more people than the other perpetrators came forward to speak out against Maria.
Yes, by the time the trial got underway, she had more testimonies against her than any other defendant in that trial.
You take us to the trial that happens eventually and the witnesses that testify and the things that they testify to. We've mentioned some of the horrors that she inflicted upon these prisoners, but what was some of the most damning evidence that was against her at this trial? And tell us about her own testimony.
Well, I think certainly the most damning piece of evidence that came up is that, you know, a lot of the testimony concerned the selections being when these transports came into the camp.
Yes.
People were selected for death in the gas chambers or to be a part of the slave labor. But of course, sadly, most people were selected for death. Mandel always maintained that, you know, the male SS officers made the decisions of who would be selected for death in the gas chamber. She wasn't involved. But a list surfaced of a list of almost 500 Greek women, which was a transport list to be sent directly to the gas chamber. And she signed that. And so this signed death list had been smuggled out to the resistance. And of course, it was entered as evidence into her trial. And so there was no way she could deny that reality. That was very concrete evidence. And then, of course, there were just dozens of very graphic testimonies of women who suffered under her punishment, saw other people killed, observed her choosing people to go to the gas chambers. So again, there was no doubt of her guilt or of her culpability in these really horrific actions.
Tell us a little bit more about the trial and the press response, the public response, and the greater public's response internationally.
Sure. I mean, this was a huge, high-profile trial. International press came, you know, so there were delegates from all over the world. There was standing room only, like, people, so many survivors had suffered in Poland. They wanted to come to the trial. They wanted to see these people on trial for their lives. They eventually, there were so many people who wanted to attend that they put loudspeakers up outside of the trial venue, and huge crowds would gather every day under these loudspeakers to listen to the testimony of these trials. And again, the press, as you might imagine, coverage ranged from level-headed coverage to very salacious coverage. Sometimes, you know, the more salacious the coverage or the more horrific the story, of course, those were the things that got a lot of attention. At the same time, you know, if a survivor wasn't asked to testify or they didn't agree with the testify, they would undergo all this other trauma. So it was very emotional atmosphere. When the prisoners were brought to the trial every day, they were unloaded at the back and there would be these huge jeering crowds that would spit at them and yell and scream at them as they were being escorted inside. So it was a very dramatic and emotional and really riveting, if I can use that word, trial. And I think people finally felt that these, at least there wasn't justice. No, there was one quote I read. The paper said, "We don't want revenge, we want justice." But I think certainly a lot of people wanted revenge as well.
She was to be hanged January 24th, 1948. In the end of this book, you write about an interesting event, a very, very interesting event regarding Maria as a prisoner in a shower. Can you tell us about this?
Yes. One of the prisoners at Auschwitz-Birkenau that had a lot of interaction with Mandel was named Stanislava Rachvalova. And Rachvalova was slightly older than a lot of the young women in the camp, and she became the source of great comfort to them. She was more mature when they got the most depressed and upset. She would tell these wonderful stories to try and take them out of where they were. Very courageous woman. She survived Auschwitz, and after the war, she became involved in a lot of anti-communist activities and eventually became the center of this huge resistance network. Was arrested for that and was sent to the same prison where the German prisoners of war had been taken, Montelupich. And so both Rachvalova and Mandel ended up being prisoners in this place. Every time Rachvalova saw her in the hall, she would spit at her or curse at her. You know, she just hated her. And then the trial happened. Maria received the death sentence. And a couple of days before the sentences were carried out, Rachvalova was taken to the prison showers, and she realized when she got there, the showers were on, and at the far end of the shower room was Maria Mandel and Teresa Brandl, the other overseer. And so she writes very vividly about this moment. They're in the shower, the water, you know, it's steam, they're naked, and she noticed Mandel walking towards her. You know, she begins almost to hyperventilate because, like, my God, this was her tormentor. She just remembered the cruelties, and Maria came up and knelt before her and asked for forgiveness for everything that she had done. And so Rakhvalova, after the fact, somewhat controversially, said, "I forgive you in the name of all the prisoners." And then they were taken back to their cells, and then Mandel was executed a few days later. Rakhvalova told some of the other prisoners right after this happened, and there was a huge, it ultimately became this huge debate in the survivor world. They felt she really had no right to forgive Mandel on everybody's behalf. Other prisoners felt that Rakhvalova was Catholic, and they said, "Well, of course you have to forgive. That's a doctrine that we believe in." And whether people agreed with her forgiveness or not, I'm very convinced that this incident did happen. Some people question if Rakhvalova made it up, but I talked to enough people who had talked to her right after this happened, people who didn't embellish. Later, years later, Rakhvalova had died, but I interviewed her daughter, and her daughter said her mother never, ever wanted to talk about any of this during her lifetime, that it wasn't something she wanted to dramatize or anything. It was just this sort of extraordinary moment where I think maybe at least Maria began to take some responsibility for what she had done. And I think for Rakhvalova, it was a way of her sort of processing her trauma and trying to figure out a way to move forward. So it was really an overcoming moment and sort of a very thought-provoking end to Mandel's life.
You also include that her friend Margit also corresponded with Franz, Maria's father, and it was a very, very interesting correspondence, again, to try to answer how on earth she became this person. And the father asked probably the same question.
Yeah, for me, you know, the whole journey of the book and my journey with Maria Mandel sort of comes to that point. I think for me, that's the heart of the book. It's like, after the war, Margit returned home. She was, you know, acquitted. She wrote to Franz because Maria had asked her to be in touch. And neither of them knew at this point that Maria had been executed. So they were asking each other for if they knew if she was okay. And then Margit was saying, you know, she was such a good friend and I loved her and don't believe these things that were said about her. And Franz Mandel wrote back this letter, which Margit shared with me. And it's just such an anguished letter from loving father. He doesn't understand what happened to her, why she followed this path. And of course, this was from a man who men were raised to be very reserved in those days. And really, his anguish is palpable on in this letter of sort of what happened to Maria and to her life and how he just doesn't understand it. And till his dying day is going to suffer this anguish of what happened with her and what she ended up doing in her life.
Yes, incredible. I want to thank you so much, Susan Eichscheid, for coming on and talking about your incredible book, Mistress of Life and Death, The Dark Journey of Maria Mandel, the Head Overseer of Auschwitz-Birkenau. For those that might want to find out more about this book, do you do any social media? And tell us when this book will be released, please.
Sure. The book has been released. It was released in the end of December, so it's out and about there. You can find it on all major bookselling sites if you just do Mistress of Life and Death. I have a website where you can learn more about sort of my journey and Maria's journey. That is just seischeid.com. So seischeid.com, my first initial and my last name. And I would welcome if anyone needs to process further, you know, that you can contact me through the website and I would be happy to answer any questions I can.
Thank you so much, Susan Eichscheid, for Mistress of Life and Death, The Dark Journey of Maria Mandel, the Head Overseer of Auschwitz-Birkenau. Thank you so much for this interview and you have a great evening and good night.
Thank you. I appreciate your time. You have a good evening too.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.